This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by
Hey everybody, Mark Davin from Guitar Radio Show. I rarely endorse a product, and let alone on my own show, but I have to share an experience that I had with Geppetto Pickups at geppettoguitars.com. When I first heard about them, I called them up and I explained what I was looking for and what I was trying to achieve sonically, and I immediately realized that they understood what I needed and they explained how they could get me there. When does that happen in the digital age? Talking to someone about what you want, having an incredible customer service experience, and then getting the pickups and them sounding like I imagined and hoped for. The quality of Mike's workmanship can be heard in every note I play. The thing that really knocks me out is when other players say to me, "Hey, what's up with that killer tone?" I say, "Go to geppettoguitars.com. I highly recommend them." Like the owner Mike O'Donohue says, "We'll give your guitar its voice, but you'll make it sing." geppettoguitars.com.
And also by
BMF Effects. BMFFX.com. Built by hand in Southern California, BMF Effects captures the tones in your record collection and brings them to life. Overdrive, fuzz, wah, boosts, chorus, compressor, and vibe pedals with a purpose. Purchase online at BMFFX.com or BMFFX official shop on Reverb. Enhance your tone and playing experience today with BMF Effects, BMFFX.com. Great tone made simple.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should.
Folks, welcome back to Guitar Radio Show. Today, we are going to dig deep. We're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about a style of music that I really love. And I'm just so enamored with, and I can't play it well. But I want to play it well. And I think I may have found a way to start playing it well. Let's hope. We're here to talk about a brand new book
that's out. It's called Contemporary Latin Jazz Guitar. And the author is with us today. And we haven't had an author of a book on in quite a while. And I'm super excited that he reached out to me to talk about this. And he's a amazing guitar player in his own right. You heard his music on the way in on the show. It was absolutely lovely. We're going to hear some more later on. Folks, please welcome the author of Contemporary Latin Jazz Guitar, Mr. Neff Izzari. How are you, sir?
Thank you. I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be with you all today.
This is really exciting for me because when you reached out, I was like, yeah, let me check it out. You sent me the book, and I sat down with it, and I was like, oh man! I mean, just comping chords, you know. I was like, oh yeah, these are the progressions that I wanna understand, and I wanna, you know, one of the things, I'm a left-handed guitar player, so you know, it's okay. It's all about my left hand for me, you know, and I've got a really good left hand. Always had a very good rhythmic left hand, and I can handle those rhythms. So to really get a better understanding of the chord progressions themselves, it was like, oh, it was like add water, makes its own sauce. I was like, oh, this is fantastic. Super excited. It makes its own salsa. Fantastic. Perfect. But I really enjoyed this book, and there's so much that I want to ask you. But before we get to know who you are, I need to know why you wrote this book. Why did you do this?
Well, part of why I wrote this book extends basically to my background, being a first generation Puerto Rican born in the U.S. And, you know, I grew up listening to Led Zeppelin and Yes and ZZ Top and playing that stuff. And my parents always had Latin music, Puerto Rican music at home playing everything from Tito Puente to Héctor Lavoe, all of this going on. And not only that, but my father was basically a music nut, so he, you know, had that, and he had, you know, Mozart, and he had all kinds of classical music, and my mother was musical. She couldn't really sing. She's always said she could sing, and so the house was always full of music. Somebody was dancing all the time. So because I grew up in Virginia, I really didn't know my background really well, besides speaking Spanish at home and knowing the stories. And I went to Puerto Rico many times as a kid. And this book, jumping over a lot of information that we'll probably cover over anyhow, this book is actually part of me re-identifying myself, refinding myself in a way, because I love the blues, and I love straight ahead jazz. That's what I do. And you know, if I was on a desert island, I would say I would take that type of music with me. But the older I got and the situations that I found myself in, I found that my identity is extremely important to who I am. And I'm sure that many people who are listening, regardless of where you're from or who you are, can agree with that. It's always good to know thyself. So while, and we're going to go back to my history again, when I was at Berkeley, I went there because I wanted to be a jazz guitar player. And so I ended up in a Latin jazz ensemble taught by the teacher, Professor Victor Mendoza. And I remember vividly the first day that I was in there, he tells me, hey, play something in clave. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. I don't know what clave is. I know from at home with my parents, I heard this music all my life. So I all of a sudden, I noticed he counted off, and I went to play, and I was doing everything right. And then I was asking him, well, he said, well, go listen to this and listen to this. And as you know, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, was there really isn't very many. There are very few books that are going to tell you exactly what a guitar player did in this type of situation. As a matter of fact, and in those books that are out there, they don't even, they give you just a method, but they don't tell you why it was or how it came about or who it was. So I went on my little investigation while I was there doing my bachelor's at Berkeley at the time, and I was lucky the following year that Steve Kahn came in, and I was chosen out because I was a performance major. And I was chosen out of all the guitar students. They only chose about a handful of guys, I think 10, 15 students to study with them. And I was in one of those. And I knew Steve's discography, and I knew that he was into Latin music, or he was about to begin, to my advantage and to my luck, when I told him what I wanted to do, that I wanted to play guitar in Latin jazz and apply all of that piano stuff and the cuatro and the tres and requinto to the guitar. Following those footsteps, he told me, well, hey, this is what you should check out. So he actually gave me specific things, and I remember vividly we went to Tower Records and we're walking among the aisle there. And he said, you should buy this record. And he told me, take a Cal Jader record, you know, that had actually Kenny Burrell and had Attila Zoller. So that actually started off with Steve, and then still, actually, the book really, I still wasn't getting the whole picture, right? So I graduated from Berkeley, and I did a little thesis about Latin jazz guitar, and then I moved out to Europe. Then I moved out to Helsinki, Finland. I got a chance to play with Julio Romero, this bass player, the famous bass player of Fania Records. He played on Ray Barreto's record Indestructible, and Julio, he gave me a chance to play the guitar without a piano player, sometimes with a piano player, but some of the best memories without a piano player, and I played all that stuff, all the things. And then he said, well, you should check out that, and, you know, check out La Playa Sextet, or check out Charlie Palmieri and Eddie Palmieri, and you know, and of course Chick Corea, which at that time Chick Corea and Eddie Palmieri are really important for harmonic devices for montunos and guajeos. So, and then I was composing my own things and putting that together, and then I realized that, hey, the Latin jazz is not only the Brazilian side, which I'm extremely fluent with, but the Afro-Cuban side, which was what I was doing in a salsa way with Julio Romero, and then I was doing it from a traditional jazz guitarist that I was raised in, that, you know, that Berkeley performance in the old Berkeley, which is Levitt and Pedersen and, you know, Peckham and Wilmot and John Damian, you know, and Gary Burton, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. Goodrich wasn't there. So this is this heavy Boston harmony mm-hmm. thing going on. So the book, just to repeat again, the book was a labor of love. It came out of my necessity to find my identity and to provide information to document everything that I was doing, so that I knew that other guitar players needed to know this. Hmm. Because there were few guitar players that were actually doing something that was interesting. Either they were playing a melody, you know, in a mambo or a rumba, but then when they get to the solo section, it was all straight ahead. You know, it was all swing, and that was it. I'm sure we're going to talk about that a little bit later. So I wanted to show, hey, well, that isn't the case. It didn't need to be the case, you know. Okay, and this was XX person to do that. So I wanted to document that and provide that as a Rubicon for everyone to say, hey, this is where you start from. This is where you check out. There's no mystery to this. Mm-hmm. And also, not only for my identity and providing information for everyone else, but also to honor those guitar players and those band leaders that actually did this, that it's being forgotten. I mean, Juanito Marquez is now in his 90s. So, mm-hmm. And then, you know, Paul Alicea, he died way earlier, and all this wonderful information just cannot remain behind a few people or in the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. This is something that more people need to know about, especially since, as a guitarist, the wealth of information on the Brazilian side of the guitar is there. But however, I must say that although my great colleague Nelson Faria has a great book on Brazilian guitar, I still believe that the information about those jazz guitar players that did that too is not being spoken about either. So that's another world we won't get into maybe. But this is why I wrote this book, and I hope that everyone can enjoy it.
It's quite the rabbit hole with additional rabbit holes, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
But how do you when you sit down to do something like this? Yeah. How do you narrow it down as to what and who you're going to cover? Because of the depth and breadth, I mean, I've got a list of players, you know, that I can think of that were key in the very creation of Latin jazz and how in different places in the world Latin jazz was happening almost simultaneously.
Absolutely.
You know. Yeah. So how do you determine, okay, who lives, who dies? You know? It's Sophie's choice. How do you do that?
Well, you know, I did an extensive, here's my academic side.
Good. All right.
Here's my academic side. I did an extensive literary review. And for those of you that are not familiar with that, I looked at all the books that are written on this stuff. And then I saw what was being written there and what wasn't, which I alluded to when I told you why I wrote the book. Then, now with deciding my criteria about who would I mention and who I wasn't going to mention. Mm-hmm. Now, the criteria was that it had to be Afro-Cuban variety of Latin jazz, for the sake that nothing has been written specifically about that and those guitar players. Now, there were a lot of guitar players that were doing the same things that I mentioned, right? And there were some that were, I'll put it this way. There were some that were exactly, there was a lot of overlap with the guitar players, okay? So some were actually just only reading, like I mentioned in the book. Let's say, for example, if we look at these, the jazz guitar players, all right? Like Barry Galbraith and Everett Barksdale, right? And in those situations where they're Jimmy Rainey, right? Mm. On those sessions that they were playing, like, or John Cora, for instance, on those sessions that they played, from the interviews that I conducted, they were just reading music, actually. Because when you listen for any other recordings, you never heard them actually playing that music. Now, if there's someone out there listening to this and say that they have the proof, please, I would love to hear it. For my criteria, because it's, you know, and here's the academic side again, qualitative and quantitative. Well, quantitative, you could go forever and it could take years and years and years. And some of those recordings, you can't get a hold of them mm-hmm. at all. So with the recordings that were available, then I narrowed it down to answer your question. Now, how? Well, we look at what are they doing stylistically. Okay, are they playing the clave? Are they playing the tumbao? Are they playing a montuno? Are they playing a guajeo? In those situations that they're playing, are they playing with a Latin rhythm section, right? Are they playing now in what time period? You know, from the 50s to the 70s, right? So if we look in that time period, we have those guitar players that I listed. We have Juanito Marquez, mm-hmm. right? We have Paul Payo Alicea, right? We have Sonny Henry, okay? All right. Now, there were other guitar players. There was Pablo Cano as well. There was Eddie Duran. But when we look at exactly how they defined, then we can see, okay, well, because, you know, this is all objective from the information and from the broad scope that I felt that I did as objective, as focused as I could. Because like I said, there could have been someone in Chicago that I had no idea about, but right. just wasn't recorded, which is probably the case, because at this same time, there were a lot of duos and trios mm-hmm. that was Latin music. Mm-hmm. Now, Latin music and Latin jazz are completely two different things, right? So I'm looking for guys that have this jazz vernacular, vocabulary at the same time, that are able to also perform the three main qualities of Latin music, which is, you know, clave, cáscara, tumbao, montunos, and guajeos, that are exhibited with Juanito, with Paul, right, and Sonny Henry. So when we get a little bit later, that's one era, okay? So I narrowed it down there, right? When I saw that, because, you know, otherwise, if I would have gave everyone the recognition, which I did with the list of influential guitar players, right? Because that's what I wanted to do there, because I felt the same way that you had just said. I felt that, well, there are some guys that really need recognition. So that's why I put them there, because they are all there. There's a process of cross-pollination, but also this assimilation and integration that everybody's checking out each other. I believe, I'm not a musicologist, but I believe that if the embargo wouldn't have happened, then the Cuban embargo, to be specific, right, then perhaps this whole Latin guitar phenomenon would have lasted a little bit longer, this Afro-Cuban, and there would have been a little bit more of an influence.
I think that's fair to say. Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's safe to speculate about mm-hmm. that. But, you know, now it's history, and we have what we have. So now when we get to when we get into the 60s, late 60s, and 70s and 80s into the modern, then we get a kind of like a blurry area, for the sake that the electric guitar comes into play, amplification, right, which was a major contribution why the piano kind of took over, right, because the piano was a bigger instrument, 88 keys, a larger sound, a mass. However, in these clubs in New York, the acoustic pianos were notoriously out of tune. Mm-hmm. So, in the advent of electrification of the guitar and the popularization, the British invasion, right? This type of assimilation that, hey, you know, a guy in the States is not going to save his money to go buy a Tres or a Cuatro. He's going to go buy a Strat or something, mm-hmm. you know, or a Les Paul. And he's going to say, well, I want to try to, you know, put this and go on my gig and try to do this and identify myself, you know, as a Cuban or a Puerto Rican and mix together, mm-hmm. which leads to this blurry area, because there was so much going on here with so many aspects of the culture, right, of popular culture and the guitar. Well, we start getting distortion, right? Which we can trace that back to Arsenio Rodriguez with the tres, and you can, you know, speculate that that might have influenced the next man that I'm going to talk about, Carlos Santana, mm-hmm. right? That sound of his turns out to be another key stylistic piece to the puzzle that includes, you know, this, like I had said, being able to play with the Latin rhythms mm-hmm. and having this distortion which fits. However, Santana is a blues guitar player.
Absolutely, yeah.
Blues rock guitar player. Absolutely. He's not a jazz guitar player. No. Even if he plays well with Laughlin, and one thing that we need to remember is that if it wasn't for Santana, I don't think I would be here talking to you about this at all, because Santana, by doing what he did for the guitar, he actually brought the role of the guitar to the forefront, mm-hmm. right? Just like what the tres was back then, right? And you know, what can I say? Santana, because he's a West Coast guy, then there are other guys that are in that same Bay Area sphere. Bobby Redfield that I mentioned, Eddie Duran, right? So, and at the same time, did Carlos actually listen to these guys? Probably he did. He probably did. His own brother, Jorge Santana. There's a lot of speculation here, but just by him, just by Carlos saying, doing Evil Ways, which was Sonny Henry, you can speculate he must have heard Willie Bobo, mm-hmm. right? He must have heard that group.
Yeah, you know? I think that's safe to say, especially like with I think Carlos was dipping into that pool as well as dipping into, you know, listening to Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton.
You Absolutely. Know,
Yardbirds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And a lot of that British invasion stuff. I mean, it was unescapable at that time, you know.
Absolutely.
So no, I think you're right. Absolutely. And then whatever, also what was going on in that neighborhood too, geography, you know, I talk about geography a lot,
you know,
on this show. And, I actually want to talk about your geography a little bit, just to ask you about, you know, you grew up in, you said, what was it? Was it Virginia?
Grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Williamsburg, Virginia. I mean, I'm sorry. That's very white bread to me.
It is white bread.
It sounds very white bread. Very homogenized. How did the geography and the music around you there influence you to become a jazz guitar player? How the hell did that happen?
this is a great story. Well, first of all, Virginia happened because my father, he's retired military.
Okay.
And after three tours in Vietnam, he decided to take my mother. My mother was in the Bronx. They got married, they moved to Virginia. And I was later born in 73. Geez, this is so much to tell you. So I was born there. My father wanted Williamsburg because my father didn't want me to grow up in... He wanted me to be as American as possible at that time period, okay? Not to, you know, to be negative or anything, but that was the situation.
It was about assimilation.
Yeah, it was about assimilation.
Yeah.
Exactly, which is, you know, yeah, it was about that. And thus my accent that you can still hear a little bit. Anyhow, so it was about that, and the good thing about Williamsburg was that we were one of the only we were basically that I knew about. We were the only family, Puerto Rican family, that was upper middle class there, you know. And my father was well known in Williamsburg, and Williamsburg at that time was, as you said, it was pretty, you know, I always under the surface I had, there were some issues growing up being, you know, of color there, but I got all the opportunities that anyone else would get. So I didn't feel at any way that I was stunted or anything like that. And as a matter of fact, Williamsburg at that time, they had a great music program there. And ever since, because I went all the way from kindergarten to high school in Williamsburg, all through there. And the teachers, everybody from B.J. Costa to Butler to Francis to Wright, Alan Wright, which was my last teacher there in high school, he founded the jazz department at Shenandoah University, Shenandoah Conservatory in Northern Virginia. So now why I became a jazz guitar player there instead of a country guitar player. My father, he wanted me to be a flat picker or a flamenco guitarist, which I didn't do. But I had a neighbor in where we lived in the housing development there. And we had a little house on a half acre land, and it was this typical, you know, Virginian type of, you know, housing area, you know, community. And his name was Donnie Phil, and he was from North Carolina, had a red beard and was balding, and he was about the blues, and he was on tour with the Platters and did all this stuff, and he was the one that told me, you know, you need to go to Berkeley, and you need to listen to this, and you need to listen to that, in a North Carolina drawl there, and he actually planted that seed. Now that seed wouldn't have grown if, when I mentioned the music pedagogy in the schools, you know, I played clarinet, I played bassoon, I played baritone sax. My eldest brother, he played 12-string guitar, so I heard. And my great uncle was a cuatro player in Puerto Rico in the South. So music is strong in my family. So Donnie, I would go down every afternoon after school, and I would play guitar with him. I had a Telecaster at the time, mm-hmm. and he would show me, you know, all this stuff, Led Zeppelin, and I would learn things by ear. And he'd tell me, well, you gotta, you know, teach me how to read music. So I would help him with that. And at this time at school with Alan Wright, that had the jazz ensemble, in order to be in the jazz ensemble, you had to be in the symphonic band. So that's why I played clarinet, and I had to do that well. And so I told him I wanted to play guitar in the jazz band. So he gave me the spot. And I got a Louis Armstrong Award for that, you know. But he started giving me, he gave me Off Ramp by Pat Metheny.
Oh, wow.
I remember he gave me that. And, you know, he died about 2 years ago? And, yeah, I never really thanked him for that. And that was really important. So when he gave me Off Ramp, I remember Donnie was giving me a bunch of records. He gave me Joe Pass and Herb Ellis. And sorry to get emotional, but it was a great time because in the big band, in the jazz band, I was playing all these Sammy Nestico charts. And I remember I had the Mel Bay book. and I think I was 15. And it was pretty heavy. I was a sophomore, and my Donnie had told me, well, Neff, you need to go to Berkeley. So I told my parents, I found out there was a 5-week program, right? That must have been in 89, 90. I told my parents, I want to go to Berkeley. And, you know, it was $500 to go. And it was a big deal at that time. $500 was a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I told my mom, I said, look, let me go because I want to know if this is, I'm thinking about really doing this as a career. So it's best that we go and we spend this little amount to know if it works, you know? So I went up there, and I did fusion, and I remember my brother's words. He told me, "No, you should have done fusion. Fusion is dead. You should have done jazz." You know, and my brother he does know, but he was right. In hindsight, you know, maybe that kind of set me aside a little bit, but not much, you know. And you can't, I tell my students that you just can't drop a young guy at 15, 16 all the way with Django Reinhardt. Maybe it can help with some people or with Herb Ellis. I always feel that you have to, introduce jazz to people if they are into Led Zeppelin and Steve Howe and whatnot. It's better to go the fusion route and then work yourself upstream like a salmon, you know. So that actually worked to my benefit, and I loved it. I really found what I really wanted to do, and then that was basically it. Basically,
it's always interesting to hear how there's always somebody.
There is. Indeed.
There's always somebody who says something to somebody else and plants that seed, and then they're off to the races. It's amazing. There's there's a section in the introduction of the book.
Yeah.
I actually have it highlighted here. You talk about something that I'm certainly intimately aware of, being a former New Yorker, growing up in New York and spending up my formative years there. This section, I want to read it to everybody here. It's Latin jazz is originally the music derived from cubop, and that unique development created by musicians in New York City. Therefore, my primary focus is the Afro-Cuban, which we've been talking about, a Cuban variety of Latin jazz, and how the electric guitar's role evolved within that style. Being a New Yorker, I'm intimately aware of that sound, that rhythm, that style of guitar playing, hearing it, that influx of it, once again, New York always being called the melting pot, right?
Yeah, yep.
And
yeah, exactly.
It was a melting pot in this instance as well, in the sense that, you know, I don't know if it's still the same now, but at one point in New York City alone, there were more Puerto Ricans in New York than there were in Puerto Rico. I don't know if that's still the case now, but Puerto Ricans, Cubans, South Americans from every country in South America, all kind of just all immigrating and coming to New York and working in New York, and then creating this mix that often enough you couldn't tell if it was Puerto Rican or if it was Brazilian. There were times when you couldn't tell because it just became this blend. It's kind of how I feel about Carlos Santana.
Yep.
You know, in the sense that he took, you know, like you said, he's a blues guitar player that's infusing Latin rhythms into this music. Perfect way to describe him. But talk a little bit about that with me in regards to Cuba.
Well, for everybody that maybe we could talk about that, you know, cubop is basically, you know, Cuban music and bebop together. So
right.
we're talking about Dizzy Gillespie, right? Juan mm-hmm. Disol, Pablo Chano Pozo.
Mm-hmm.
And Chano Pozo was the percussionist for Dizzy. Juan Disol was another a composer that wrote Caravan. Okay? So what we're getting is that we're getting the bebop, these heads of Caravan and Tintindale and Woody and You, Night in Tunisia, over mambo, rumba, cha-cha-cha, right? So that's basically, just to put it simply like that, that's what's going on right there,
mm-hmm.
okay? So we have these heads, and the interesting thing is that these Charlie Parker has these bebop heads, the way that they are already, that they are phrased and written, they naturally fit over the clave. What people have to remember is that jazz, the third line, the second line, excuse me, not the third line, the second line, you know, the second line is, you know, duck, 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 right? So we have that. That's the first part of the clave, right? So when we have these, right? Mm-hmm. So I did it with the 2-3 clave. You see how naturally it'll go with it,
right?
Right. So it's just a matter of, and I talk about this in the book, that it if you accent it with the rhythm of the cascara or the clave, that's going to be a way of getting into it. Now, I define what cubop was, and cubop is important for that reason, that they, that the repertoire of Latin jazz was defined at that time, right? Okay, and it assimilated those musicians together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because before that, there were, like I said, I'm not a musicologist. There were the jazz musicians were recording in Cuba, mm-hmm. and they were going back and forth. Mm-hmm. They were going back and forth. You know, there's the story of Nat King Cole recording in Egrem there, and there's all kinds of things. There's lots of correlations and similarities going on between the inceptions of Cuba, right? The inceptions of how this cross-pollination is going on, this hybridization of jazz. And then also, cubop leads to the, you know, is underlying when we have this cha-cha-cha. But there was a craze. Before the embargo, it was an Afro-Cuban craze.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, I remember my parents, you know, that music was in my household. My dad would buy those records.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them dancing.
Yeah, there you go.
You know?
Yeah.
And I would say, well, you know, a little kid, you know, what are you doing? What are you doing? Cha-chas. I was like, okay. I didn't understand, but yeah, it's amazing. Absolutely, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about gear.
Okay.
And particularly the gear of Latin jazz.
Okay.
You know. Your average rock guitar player or metal guitar player has his Marshall Stack or his Boogie and his Les Paul or his PRS or what, Strat, whatever.
Yeah.
What does it look like? I mean, I know hanging out with, you know, and he wasn't a Latin jazz player, but hanging out with Les Paul, mm-hmm. it was always a really simple, very simple rig.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The most complicated thing usually was the guitar. You know, I mean, the guy used Boss pedals.
Oh, there you go.
He just,
okay.
He had four or five Boss pedals in one of those tiny little plastic cases. And that's all he had. you know, once again, he was like, just keep it simple.
Like, oh, yeah, exactly.
Right, okay. So tell me about that. What, I mean, and then I want to talk about your gear, but tell me about
it. All right. Okay. Well, interesting enough, a Charvel with humbuckings and a good distortion, a tube screamer, could be the perfect remedy if you're playing in a loud situation with a lot of percussion and horns. Somehow, I'm going to take Steve Kahn's words, quote my dear mentor Steve about this, and I believe it's true that in some ways, Carlos's sound, the distortion, is a good sound to cut through, actually,
mm-hmm.
you know? As powerful and it gives you the sense and it gives you enough headroom. Well, we can't talk about headroom in those senses, but it gives it, it cuts through in the mix. That, let's leave it simply like that. And also, I can agree with what you said about Les Paul. On these salsa gigs, you don't want to be carrying a lot of stuff. You want to have a little amp, you know, that's strong enough, maybe a 100-watt amp, and some type of effects, and a semi-hollow body guitar, right? You can do it depending on the instrumentation. Sometimes it could be that you could have, depending, let's say that it's just piano, bass, and drums. Maybe you would want a nylon string like a Godin, which is lovely sound with an acoustic piano, or even with a Rhodes. And then that touches back to our folkloric roots as guitar players, right? For me personally, I enjoy a semi-hollow body guitar with that, without a piano player, and with percussion and a bassist, either electric bass or baby bass or acoustic bass. And that works perfectly fine with me. On these salsa gigs, I used to take my 175 out, and I would play that, and it was perfectly fine. Now that has a pickup on the face of it. You know, it's not an arch top, so it's fine, no feedback problems. And then the 345, the block in the middle, is just perfect. So that would be the typical thing. And then also, if you're really really aficionado about this music, a specialist, then you might take with you a tres or a cuatro if you would have it, you know. And I've even seen guys do the, you know, a 12 string conversion where they take out the B and the A strings and they leave the three, the low E in the middle and the high E, you know, in the middle G, or whichever spacing they want. You know, I think it would be, you would take out, yeah, or you'd have to cut a completely new nut on there to do that. So that's what they used to do when they couldn't get it. And as a matter of fact, what is his name? There's a famous New York guitar player, Nelson Gonzalez, that has one of those 12 string. You can see him on one of those links that I have in the book on YouTube doing that. So it can be that. You know, it all depends how, what you feel, basically whatever your sound is, if you can make it work in that percussive, loud percussive environment, and make it fat and big, and it in my opinion it should be stereo, then yeah, go for it, you know.
Yeah And you say, so you're currently using an ES-175?
I have a ES-175 from 1964. I use that. I also have a Gibson ES-345. I've always been a Gibson boy all my life. And then I have, which I'm proud to be sponsored by Sharpach Master Guitars from Holland. Theo's a fantastic luthier. He made me an Opus G, a one-off of that with a floating humbucker Dickinson pickup. And I love that guitar to pieces. I never had a new guitar, so that's really nice, and that's a true arch top. Lovely guitar.
Nice. You have to send me a link to their website. I'll put it in the show notes for sure. Folks, when you go to this episode on guitarradioshow.com, there'll be video, there'll be links to all things for Neff and this book. And there's some really cool videos on YouTube that I'll also put up as well. So check those out for sure, as well as the link to, what's the name of the guitar company again?
It's Sharpach, S-C-H-A-R-P-A-C-H.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And so what are you doing as far as amps right now?
Well, I am a vintage guy, and I still have in the States a Twin Reverb Silverface at my brother's place. And I actually have three amp heads. I have two Pierce G1s that were originally Steve Kahn's. And then my favorite out of the three is a Pierce G2R that from the 80s. I have that, and I have that modded, that I had it modded in Helsinki with some friends of mine. And I have a Mutron C200 volume pedal, volume wall that I use, that Santana's, you know, secret weapon as well. And a Nova system that I use, TC Electronics Nova system. I have all Vovox cables. I run in stereo, and I have two Mesa Boogie 1x12 open back cabinets with 90-watt Celestion Black Widows that are lovely. Let's see here. And yeah, man, and all kinds of different things. A Korg DVP-1 and a TC-1210 spatial expander that I use sometimes, and a DCF-10 Ibanez. And also, I also do play guitar synth. I have a GR-300, a white one, a rare white one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and yeah, I've recorded with that. And
is that the double cut? The double cutaway?
It's the double cutaway. Yeah, yeah, it's a lovely one. Yeah, it's a fantastic guitar. And I had that modded to the Roland guy up in Finland. He's a good friend of mine, a Roland technician, and we did all kinds of stuff with it, and it's just fantastic. And also, there's a good side on that. I have been in contact with him, Wayne Jones, actually. He has a good side dedicated to the GR300.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was the best iteration of the guitar synthesizer.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I got a chance to meet Ryo Kawasaki.
Oh yeah,
and Ryo, unfortunately, he passed away about 3-4 years ago. He lived in Estonia, and he was just amazing. And I remember he had a Yamaha 335 that was modded for it, and we didn't get a chance to speak about that. I remember we were on a gig and we were playing some Latin stuff together, which was fun.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
So. But anyhow, and then I guess you want to know about strings. I play with heavy gauge strings from 12 to 52, Kurt Mangan strings. I've been with Kurt for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then for the archtop, for the Sharpach, I put 13 and 17 on the top two because, you know, for the archtop, it needs a little bit heavier string. But I've used 12s forever. And, you know, and Gibson GG50 pick. You know, the picks that they don't have any, they don't make them anymore. I have a bunch of them. So very picky about my stuff, as a guitar player should be, but you should try everything, you know.
Find what works. And
exactly, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was obsessing over this one particular Fender medium pickup that I had found at I was at the Eric Clapton Crossroads Festival in Dallas.
Oh, lovely.
And I went to the Fender booth, and they were handing out these picks that had Fender Play on them, that just said Fender Play, and then it had a website on the back. And I was like, huh, these really feel good. So I grabbed a handful, put them in my pocket, got home, and I became obsessed with the way they felt. And the, you know, I'm like, what's wrong with me? But, you know, I became obsessed, and I went on a hunt to try and find more. I still have not been able to find them, but
yeah, that's
that. Oh, I remember those. Those are from the 70s.
Yeah, you know what I did? I found them in England, and I bought a huge amount of them.
Yeah, so these are the Gibson. They're not quite a teardrop. They're but in between a teardrop and a Fender medium style.
Yeah, and and I don't know why Gibson discontinued them, but they are just fantastic. And I use them for everything.
Yeah.
I've used this since I was 16, this type of pick.
And that's a heavy?
No, it's a medium.
It's a medium.
I play with medium pick, you know. Mm. And, you know, it's all about with my right hand, I'm always moving where the note is on the string and playing on them, as you know. And then with my strength laying off a lot of legato and the left and right hands. So it was really important, and I hope that everyone gets a chance to do it, and I'm sure you can agree with this, Mark, is that it's really important to stick with something for a long time to give it a chance to see if it really works.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You could really lose yourself, and like Les Paul had said, these are tools. You gotta be able to know what they do and take advantage of them. And if you find something good, don't, you know, Don't, if it ain't broken, don't fix it.
Exactly. You know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I know that you're working on another book.
Yes.
But where do you want to go with this book? Where do you want to go with it?
Well, this is interesting because what I really want with this book is to help others so that others would get an idea about what is Afro-Cuban guitar. Mm-hmm. What is the other side of Latin jazz guitar? So they get an idea. So they don't think, okay, Latin jazz guitar is only the Brazilian or only the flamenco right. thing. And to bring light to, you know, forgotten guitar players, that's important. That's really important for me. To keep the tradition going. It's very important. Not to do the same things that they did, but to learn the tools and to be creative, just as creative as they would. And I believe that everyone can do it.
You did that for me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then, you know, to educate, to motivate, to inspire, right? And basically what people need is just the tools and a departure point. And tools that are not just, okay, this is my method, try it out, you know. No, actually a method that's has some type of integrity and that is built off something that mm-hmm. is credible. Mm-hmm. That's really important. Because mm-hmm. there's if you look on the net and you look everywhere and there's a mass of information all over. But really, when you had spoken of, when you asked me, and I hope I answered the question properly, about how do you differentiate with, you know, how do you figure out who is doing the most innovative thing? Well, because of my experience studying with all these famous guitar players, being at Berkeley twice, doing my bachelor's and my master's, and playing with everybody from Jimmy Haslip to Eddie Henderson, doing all this stuff, and still being humble and learning and listening and not forgetting to keep on practice and develop, I gained this, I don't know how it happened, but I gained this type of objectivity and this analytical sense of knowing, hey, this is actually something that is different from what was gone happened before. Because I was lucky to, you know, to go up through that whole regimen of learning, right? Which a lot of people, they get discouraged by something like that, and then you get a certain type of a school of thought that says, well, you don't really need to do that. You just need to get the right recordings and whatnot, and you know, and there's a lot. This could be another discussion. But I really do believe that if you analyze, be reflective about what you do and keep notes and grow and seek out the right type of information, then you're only going to benefit. Mm-hmm. And this is what I want to do with the book. And I'm hoping also that, you know, the next generation of because nowadays diversity and inclusion is very important for our society nowadays, that those Latinos that might be listening, and even everyone else, it doesn't matter from what background you are, to take from the rich heritage that the guitar has. There's a reason why there's an ES in front of the guitar, electric Spanish. Mm-hmm. So why not go and check it out? Mm-hmm. You know, and also hopefully it'll inspire for people to understand, if you can see behind what is actually the main, what am I getting through? What am I peddling in the book, as you can say, if you use that, then it might even help you understand why is Matheny doing what he's doing, or why is McLaughlin doing what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Maybe it can help someone to develop something, to go somewhere completely new. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Now, The second book, this first book is just setting the information out there and putting who are the guitar players. But as you can see, there's lots of rabbit holes that we could go down to your word, this book. And I felt that I could spend a little more time on the linear, you know, on the soloing. What makes it? What did they do? You know, and also, what montuno, what pattern do I play here and there? You know, and okay, Neff, this shows me I'm playing along with you, but I'm on a Latin jazz gig, and I don't know exactly what to do. So I'm hoping that the second book will address these types of things as well, you know, in some way that'll give them, hey, this is how you're going to use these tools, right?
Cool. I think that's great. So you have a lecture coming up in London?
Yes, I do. I have a lecture November 28th through the 30th. Uh-huh. It's going to culminate in a concert. It's at the SOAS University of London. And in the fall, things are so that'll be in November. In the fall, I hope to be in the U.S. and in the springtime as well, probably at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. Also, Berkeley's been interested as well, so I'll be at my alma mater, hopefully.
That's wonderful.
And I hope to get down and meet you in person and, you know, and do this, that do would, some more like
that would be
state.
Great. That would be wonderful. Now, and you're also working on a record right now too, right?
I am working on a record. It's going to be produced by Jimmy Haslip. It's going to feature Victor Mendoza on vibraphone, Leslie Lopez and Ricardo Padilla, and probably a drum set player. I don't know who yet, but I'm working on that now. So it'll be yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, because when I put out my first record, Nepenthe, which was produced by Jimmy, that was in 2000. And then I got sidetracked with all kinds of other projects, with the family, with life. And that was a good thing. And all of a sudden, I noticed that, I amassed quite a number of compositions. So I better record something now. And to give a little bit, you know, more sources for the book as well, right? So, yeah, so that's where I'm at. And I believe probably by the end of the year that should come out, yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm looking forward to that. Now, it's going to be all original music, or are you
going
to...
Yes, it will be. It'll be all original music. I probably, if I do, I've been thinking about doing a cover of something, but I'm not so sure yet, but I really want to get my original compositions out there. So, but they will be quite. They will resemble things that are familiar in the book. So, you know, and things that are familiar to Latin jazz, anyhow. So,
cool. Yeah, that's great. As I was saying to you, well, I don't think I said this on mic, but one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book, beyond all the great. I mean, I've got it right here, folks, in front of me. So if you hear me turning pages, deal with it. But I love the discography that you put in the back, the timeline that you put in the back here, and the anthology of influential guitarists in Latin jazz, which is great because it's like literally we can just go, ooh, I'm going to go and dig down. I'm going to dig down this one, dig down on this one. But it's great that you did this from 1950 to the present of just going all the way through, and it makes me want to ask you more questions. So
yeah.
So when you and I first chatted, we started talking about George Benson.
Oh yeah.
And you know how he originally kind of started as a rhythm and blues kind of guitar player.
Yeah.
And suddenly he shifted and found and became this, you know, in many respects, an impresario. You elaborate on George Benson for me.
Well, I think the best quote, and I hope if George is listening, you know, that he gets me, he can correct me on this. The only one that can do George Benson well is George himself.
That's
only George.
That's the truth.
George is fantastic in the way that he plays on the few instances that he's playing Latin music, that he's playing Latin jazz.
Like on Old Devil Moon.
Yeah, like on Old Devil Moon, on that recording, and that arrangement of Old Devil Moon is by Sonny Bravo, which is Tito Puente's piano player, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
On that recording, the way that he we're gonna use musician's lingo, the way that he hooks up with the rhythm section,
mm-hmm.
it sounds like he's played that music forever. It sounds the way. And when you, and I've listened to that, and I'm gonna mention another track, and I've slowed it down, and the way that he phrases, he's marking, he plays it as if he is from there. There's a level of genius and talent. He does this in Brazilian music as well on a track called Eternally as well. That is wonderful. And the way that, and this Old Devil Moon is important track because on Old Devil Moon, the bass player, he loses himself with the tumbao, which is across the bar line. Doom, ding, doom, doom. He loses himself, and because of the way that the polyrhythms that Benson is playing across the bar line, and Benson still keeps the time with the clave, and there is something very important that Latin jazz is being able to play salsa and knowing jazz quite well.
Mm-hmm.
However, you can be a great jazz musician, but that doesn't mean that you are gonna play Latin music very well. That doesn't guarantee anything. In George Benson's case, you know, he breaks the mold there, and he does that on there extremely well. As a matter of fact, he even plays something like a montuno there as well, octaves, mm-hmm. like with class, which is important. And in my book, I talk about that octave technique with single notes,
yeah.
mixing them together, which is extremely important. And not only does Benson do that, but he also does it again with Jorge Dalto on My Latin Brother on this recording. And if you're aware of George Benson's discography, he does My Latin Brother again, but he does it in as a Brazilian. He does it as a like a samba version of that, kind of a bossa nova, but more on the samba side. And he phrases incredibly well with that as well. So there's a level of our legends that we. I remember that when you first realize, oh my God, you know. He's amazing. You know, when you're transcribing someone and you're playing along after years of transcribing them, and then when you just reflect, this is really incredible. And when you see them play and being next, it's like, you know, every time I listen to Steve Kahn, I still think he's so incredible. And I'm so blessed, you know, to have him there, you know. And this, you know, it's just incredible. And George Benson is one of those persons that what he does from his background, I think that's enough inspiration that you don't have to be Puerto Rican or Cuban to do this.
Mm-hmm.
However, you need to be able to understand by having those types of models, examples, so that you can see, hey, this is why he did it.
Right.
This is how it is.
Right.
And rather than just to throw the I have them transcribed and it's gonna come out in the next book probably.
Cool.
but so I can show it exactly. But yeah, what's really important is that I believe because I'm a teacher, you know, and educator, is that. You know, I want to teach you how to fish. I don't want to give the fish to you.
Right.
And this book does provide, to use the analogy, it provides the fish, but also in there it shows you how to do it.
To go get more fish.
Go get more fish.
Yeah.
So the entry level is quite, you know, you gotta have certain things happening, and if you don't, then learning a different style will help you to appreciate your own style again, mm-hmm. which is very important. Mm-hmm. So that's what I can say about George Benson. It's incredible, and it's really spooky because there are moments in this Jorge D'Alto recording where George Benson is comping, and he's exactly with the piano player. He's exactly note for note, and you don't know whether there were a lot of rehearsals, you just don't know. And hopefully I get a chance to speak to George about that session, you know. But anyhow, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but, yeah. Go ahead.
George, when I think of George Benson, I can't help not think of Grant Green.
Of course. Yeah. And my Latin bit. Yeah. And they were close. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And once again, another cat who was kind of all over the map. I mean, he did Latin. He could play Latin jazz. He played funky kind of stuff. He played, you know, straight ahead jazz. He even tried his hand at a little like popular sounding, you know, tunes of the day, you know, type of stuff. That chameleon-esque quality to the music, I think, only helps to being able to play in all those different styles will ultimately, once you land on a particular style, will help you really, really dig in even further.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is, and I'm glad you brought this up, because this is what in order to understand and appreciate our legends and how to live up to that, you know, even if, you know, there's a famous saying, you aim for the stars and you fall short. That's actually quite high.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this whole concept of contemporary Latin jazz guitar and all these great guitar players that you know, they attempted to do this and they executed it, it's to encourage us to do the same. Right. And to, yeah, it's just incredible.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah, I just think this is such a great book, and I was really taken with it immediately upon its arrival. And the more time I spent with it, I was like, oh, this is just, it's a fun place to be.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear it.
Really, really.
It was a fun place to be to do it. I mean, the book basically took like 20 years to write, basically.
Wow.
You know, because I had to, I keep notebooks of information. I'm always writing down. If I meet someone interesting, I always jot down what they say, and that actually helped. And then it took a year basically to write it, and it's part of my thesis that I did. Mm-hmm. So I think it was needed. I really do think it was needed, and I hope everybody enjoys it for sure.
Other than yourself, who would you recommend to listeners of players that are out there right now playing this genre? Who should people be listening to?
I would say first and foremost, Steve Kahn.
Mm.
I would say Steve Kahn. That is where you're going to get a guitar player without a piano player.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to get the maximum. You're going to really get the maximum of pushing the envelope. I would also, there's also Ray Oviedo. Mm-hmm. That has a Latin project with the big band, which is incredible. And then from there are some guitar players in there's Jorge Lavoy in Puerto Rico that it has played on some Gilberto Santa Rosa records, which is a fantastic guitar player. And then there are very few guys out there that are actually doing something really, really interesting. You know, there's I can't remember his name in Cuba, and he lives in Havana. There's one that is playing nylon string. I can send that name to you. I don't remember his name. But he's another obscure guy. There's also René Toledo, which is another legend that lives in Nevada, in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. There was also Ramon Stagnaro that just recently passed away a couple of days ago, the brother of Oscar Stagnaro. And I believe there is a guitar player by the name of Ramon Pardo that's seeing a Cuban guitar player in New York at the moment. And you can check out these guys on YouTube if you put Latin jazz guitar, and you'll find some guys. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, you can decide for yourself who's doing something that really reaches out. And it's good to be objective and see, because at that point, if a very famous teacher of mine told me one time, I wish I had someone else's ears to hear what they hear. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. So mm-hmm. rather than to lead someone somewhere, I think it's good just write it down and go check them out and see what's going on. And if it's happening, then if it's happening for you, then it's happening.
Yeah. You know? No, that's true. I agree with that. Absolutely. And to try and, you know, like for me, you know, I must listen to 100 hours of music a week.
Yeah.
You know, because of all the music that comes my way and people wanting to come on the show or people that I've reached out to and listening to and then just listening to the music that I want to listen to.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so listening without prejudice.
That's
key.
That's hard to do.
It is sometimes, yeah, because it's not often, it doesn't have to be something that I necessarily like.
Yeah.
For it to be good.
Exactly. That's it. And that's where it comes your experience and you. And another very famous teacher of mine told me, you know, when I go to a gig, I expect that the guy can play, you know, all his scales and knows his chords, you know, and has a good sound. If I'm going to go and it didn't happen, and then, you know, forget it, you know, then I know. So everyone has, you know, it might be that, okay, you know, yeah. He's got to have that overdrive sound, you right. know, and he's got that Strat thing. Yeah. And
well, and then I've been at shows where everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. And,
but that's fun too.
And it was an amazing performance.
There you go. Yeah.
I went to see an alternative band and a guitar player that I knew here in Austin. And I went to see him play and he was super excited that I was finally getting to come out and see him play. And I was excited to see him play. And 30 seconds into the first song of the set, the amp blows up and he breaks a string. And it's just a complete cluster F. And so another band pushes an amp up that he's never played. Pushes actually, you know, they're an alt band. He pushes up a Roland JC-120.
No way.
And he plugs into that and he puts his pedal board into that. And it was the strangest, weirdest thing. I mean, it just sounded completely different than what he wanted it to sound like. And it was magical.
And he made it work.
It was magical. I left there going, oh my God, that was amazing. But that's not what he said, but that's not what we sound like. I said, well, maybe it's time to reconsider. I said, this
you know,
is
stereo chorus. Will
yeah,
do it, you know?
he actually started shopping for a JC-120 after that.
Those are killer amps, and those, you know,
they're amazing. They're amazing.
Speaker ones, the small ones.
Man. Oh, the JC-60 or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brent Fine in Denmark has one, a vibraphonist, and every time I go with him, I play through it, and it's just amazing.
It's a brilliant amp. I had a JC-120 for 10 years. It was wonderful. I'm sorry I got rid of it.
Yeah.
I really am. Man. And I played rock through that amp.
Yeah, oh yeah, you can.
Well, it's absolutely a clean platform, and then, you know, you put any dirt pedals in front of it and go to town. I actually heard, you know who Paul Gilbert is from?
Yes, I do.
Okay. He talks about a show that he had a fly-in gig, and he was late, and it was all first come, first serve. So everybody got to pick what they wanted from the back line, and he gets there, and all that's left is a JC121.
Oh, man.
And he's like, what am I going to do? You know, doing what he does. You know, of course, he had his pedal board. And he had some preconceived notion of that amp. And he said, well, let me give it a shot. Let me try what I can, see what I can do. And he was like, this is amazing. And it is. It's a really great amp. Joanna Connor from Chicago. She's a blues guitar player. Loud, raucous, wonderful blues guitarist. I mean, just total. That old saying, overnight sensation. She's an overnight sensation in 20 years. You know, she's been at it for a very, very long time. She really knows her craft, and she uses a JC120. And you would swear it's a tweed.
Oh,
or
really?
Something like
it's that or a super.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah, for sure. Man, I got to tell you, this has been wonderful. Folks, when we first started talking about doing this, I did something with Neff that I rarely do, and for future guests, don't ask, because I usually don't do this, I did a pre-interview with him, so it's just so we could cover some of the stuff that we were going to talk about. And I told him, I said, don't tell me too much because you're going to tell me gold. And we hopefully we'll be able to recreate it. And he's, of course, but he went off and he started telling me great stuff. So I recorded that too. So you never know. I might drop some of that in here.
I drop it. Okay, lovely.
You never know. But I think this is a great book. Folks, please go check out this book. There'll be a picture of the cover of the book. There'll be links to where you can purchase the book. It's called Contemporary Latin Jazz Guitar. It's on, is it Shure Music?
Shure Music.
Shure Music Company. It's the best $28 you can spend, I got to tell you. It's really a great, great book. How can people order the book, Neff?
Well, they can order from online. If you go to the website, www.sharemusic.com, and you'll see the Contemporary Latin Jazz Guitar there. And you can do through there. If you get the opportunity to see me in the U.S. at a clinic or a masterclass, then you can come and buy a copy straight from me as well.
Oh, great. Yeah. And then there'll be an autograph somewhere in
there? Absolutely. There'll be an autograph, and I'll tell you a tip or something about about one of the exercises.
That's cool. Yeah. And you're still currently teaching now?
Yes, I'm a guest lecturer abroad, and now what I'm doing is basically just composing and working on the next book and have private students. So, absolutely.
Well, this is great. I'm super excited for you and everybody else out there. Go check it out, folks. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. You hold on, but we're going to sign off right here.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, guitarradioshow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.
GRS Productions.
Unchained Brands. Unchainedbrands.com. Rock and roll accessories that give back. Handcrafted pendants, chains, necklaces, earrings, and wearables that symbolize the union of the music community. Unchained Brands is proud to provide a portion of their proceeds to benefit Music Cares, a nonprofit organization that provides a safety net of critical assistance, education, pathways to recovery, and support for all music people in times of need. Together, we will lead the journey to inspire through our products and our community. Come join us. Find Unchained Brands on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and at unchainedbrands.com.